Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. I should say welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In the year 2005, more than 2 million Americans declared bankruptcy. Millions more are deeply in debt. The personal savings rate here in the United States is at its lowest point since the Great Depression. This morning, in this part of the show, the question we ask is why Americans can't hold on to their money. That also happens to be the subtitle of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning. And our guest is the author, Stuart Vise. He's professor of psychology at Connecticut College, which is located in New London, Connecticut. He is the author of the book Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. The book is published by the Oxford University Press, and in part it takes a look at some of the ways that we explain this big problem of debt in this country and why it is that the conventional explanations don't really go far enough, and perhaps something of what psychology can tell us about why people have money problems. He is the author of another book, and that book published some years back, Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. In fact, that won the William James Book Award in 1999. He is a frequent commentator on irrational behavior. Has been quoted in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. He's also been widely interviewed on CNN, on CBC, on NPR, and we're pleased to have him this morning joining us by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, which is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. By the way, before we get going here, I'd just like to pass on to you a weather-related closing. We are expecting the possibility of some significant snow here in our part of the country today, and we may indeed have more of these, but this is the first one that we've gotten here. St. Joe Ogden and St. Joe Schools will be closing. St. Joe Middle School will be dismissing at 12:20. The St. Joe Grade School at 12:30. St. Joe Ogden High School at 12:40. And Prairie View Ogden School at 12:45. And I'm sure that as we proceed here throughout the day and throughout the afternoon, that we'll have more weather-related information for you. And as soon as we do get that information, why, we'll pass it right on to you. And now we will say good morning and hello to our guest, Professor Vise. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Very glad to be here.
This, I don't want to snow people under right at the beginning here with a lot of statistics, and maybe we don't even need to do that to remind people just what a serious problem we have here with debt in this country. But it is striking just having said that, though, I guess it's still striking just how significant it is. And particularly, there's one graph here in the book that takes a look at debt, total household debt as percentage of after-tax income between, and it shows what's happened between 1952 and 2004, when over that period of time it's gone steadily up. And there's a figure in here that you quote that, in fact, let me see here. The average American household owes 20% more money than it makes in a year. Now, that does include things like people's mortgages, but it also includes an awful lot of credit card debt.
Absolutely.
These numbers seem to me to be quite significant.
Yeah, they are, and they have really gone up in the last, especially the last 30 years, but even, much more so in recent years. Yeah, it's a serious problem. I don't think we actually have to go over the statistics because everybody kind of knows. There's a sense now that many, many people are in debt up to their eyeballs, and it's a big problem. The foreclosure crisis has just made it even more visible than it was before.
Yeah, it seems to be that it's still to some extent the case that I think people are hesitant to talk about their financial situation. It's one of those things that you're not, up there with religion and politics that you're not supposed to ask people about. And I suppose that there indeed can be some shame associated with having financial problems. At the same time, it seems, though, that people are maybe a little bit more willing now actually to admit to having financial difficulty. And maybe, in fact, some people are, if you're that bad off, it's not something that you can hide.
Yeah, I think that because it is so widespread, you know, there's sort of a social norming phenomenon that that so many people are in fact in debt that that you know there's a little less of a stigma about admitting it because you know your neighbors are in the same situation. But it is true that you can keep it private if you want, for the most part, and there is still shame associated with being in debt or having financial problems, much less than in the past, because the credit card companies, in particular, have worked very hard to eliminate that shame. They you know, they encourage you to use your credit, your debt for anything, a baseball game, trips, and so on. And so much of what would have been a taboo with respect to getting into debt has been taken away. So it has changed quite a bit. There is shame still. But not as much as in the past.
Yeah, certainly it is the case that psychologists are interested in various kinds of problems with impulse control, and I suppose spending money can take that kind of form. So I suppose it can be overspending can be viewed as a kind of pathology. You note in the book that perhaps the field is not quite ready yet to say that being in debt and having financial problems is a disease condition. But is this in fact something that psychologists are starting to or have been in recent years spending more time thinking about?
Yes. The American Psychiatric Association is considering the possibility of adding compulsive spending as an actual mental illness category in their big book of disorders. But my view as a psychologist is that it's too widespread a problem to be really an illness. I think that when you get to the point, usually we think of a mental illness as being something that affects a relatively few people. But once it gets to be millions and millions, then I think we have to look outside the individual at the environment that we've created. And that's basically what my point of view is in the book, that we've created a circumstance in which it's much harder to be good. We've put tremendous demands on our self-control that weren't there 30 years ago. And so it's only natural that millions of people would find themselves in trouble.
Yeah, I think, as you rightly point out, I think one has to be very careful that you don't somehow give people the message that if you have financial difficulties, that's somehow a sign of moral weakness, and that it's really... obviously, you can't say that it's not their fault at all.
Right.
But as I think you have to be very careful about making this into some kind of personal failure on that individual's part.
Absolutely. There are an awful lot of factors that go into this. I think that it's not just, you know, the simple thing of I have a credit card and I can't control myself from using it. There are other things that have helped to create this epidemic besides that simple problem. One of which is, for example, that our economy has become much less certain in the last few years. More and more people are working combinations of part-time jobs without benefits. They're subject to sudden layoffs or decreases in income. And so their income stream is much more volatile than it was in the past. And in fact, wages have gone down for a large number of people in the last couple of decades. So it is a much more sort of risky environment for the worker now. And then if you combine that with lots of debt and not very much saving, then you have a real problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that you suggest is that some of the standard explanations for how we explain this don't go far enough. It's not that they're wrong, but it's that they're incomplete. And you've here just touched on one of them. We've talked about the fact that Americans do have a lot of debt, and a lot of that is unsecured credit card debt. And that some people say, well, the problem here is that it's simply too easy to get. There are so many people who are willing to extend you credit and continue to raise the limit on cards. It's not like it used to be when credit cards. There was a time when credit cards were rare. Not that many people had them. Many of them were cards that that didn't revolve. At the end of the month, you had to pay it off. Now it is much easier to get them. The limits keep going up all the time. The credit card company is happy to say, "Oh, don't want to pay it off this month. That's fine. You can carry a balance." Of course, they charge you interest, but you can carry the balance. All in all, it's a case of credit just too available.
Well, that is one of the common explanations, and I would have to say it has some truth to it. I mean, people are extended credit well beyond, and the foreclosure crisis is an example of that, but credit cards have been doing it for a long time, too. They extend more credit than the person can reasonably handle. And then, of course, there's all the fees and so forth that make it all that much more difficult because your balance goes up so quickly. Excuse me. That's part of the explanation is probably true. But the other part is that is that income volatility issue that I mentioned, and also the fact that we have now the ability to buy things 24 hours a day. And we didn't have that before. It wasn't the case that you could buy a car without getting up off the couch, which is the case now. And so the demands on our self-control are much worse. We do have to think about things and try to keep from making those decisions almost every hour of the day. You are in a commercial marketplace, whereas in the past when you went home, you were pretty much free and clear. You didn't have to think about buying anything. You couldn't buy anything, and it was easier in that sense to be good.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest, Stuart Vise. He's professor of psychology at Connecticut College. That's in New London, Connecticut. And he is the author of the book, Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. And it's published by the Oxford University Press, which takes a look at the financial difficulties that many Americans face today and tries to get at some understanding of why. And then maybe also suggest some solutions or some approaches to the problem. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. It seems that part of the difficulty here is the difficulty of individuals to delay gratification. It seems difficult for people to say if they want something that they can wait. Now, in the past, again, it would have been easier. Maybe people would have had to wait. If they wanted to buy some big ticket item, they would have had to save for it. But now, as you say, credit is easily available. Many, many people have those plastic cards in their wallet. We are being marketed to 24 hours a day. There are opportunities to shop 24 hours a day. And so it seems to require an awful lot of self-control. If you see something, to not say to yourself, well, why do I need to wait? I could have that thing right now. I could go right out to the store and I could buy it. I could pick up the telephone. I could order it. And in a matter of days, this thing could be here dropped at my doorstep. Why wait? Why does it seem that that's such a difficult thing?
Well, that's part of the sort of new psychological analysis of self-control, which has emerged in the last couple of years, that shows that when a decision can be made very quickly, when you can have something immediately, we do, unfortunately, make different decisions than if we had to wait. Our preferences change, and that's been shown in many, many circumstances to be the case. It actually goes against what economists have been saying for decades. They've felt as though preferences should be the same no matter whether it's, you know, a close decision or a distant decision. And when we have a marketplace now where the choice of buying something is always in front of you and you can have something almost instantly because you have a credit card in your pocket and because the items can be purchased so quickly, it blinds us to our sort of longer-term goals. We all would really like to have a, you know, comfortable retirement, larger things that we're saving for in the future. We'd like to be able to handle unexpected expenses that come up. But those things are in the murky future, and we don't think about them, and we think, you know, we have a tendency to be sort of overconfident and think that, well, that'll be fine. I'll be fine with that. But the thing that's standing there in front of you, the thing you want to buy now, an iPod, an iPhone, whatever it is, that tends to be very, very salient for people. And that's the problem, is that unfortunately we're confronted with those kinds of immediate decisions today in a way we never were before.
Yeah. So again, this goes back to the idea of it's not so much that people are weak or stupid. At least in part, it's that the environment pushes us in directions that it's difficult to resist.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we do have to hold people responsible for their decisions to a degree. I mean, you know, there is some choice in these decisions, but to blame it entirely on, for example, a generation of irresponsible people, I think is wrong. I think that it ignores the tremendous changes that we've created in our environment. And remember, you know, we now have a service economy that is based entirely on consumer purchasing. I mean, I think it's 70% or 80% of our economy is a consumer economy. It's based on buying and selling of items to each other, and so we've been really encouraged in this regard. You know, when 9/11 happened, we were supposed to go out and spend, and the stimulus package that has been passed recently is supposed to be used in spending to try to bolster the stock market, and so this is the way our economy is designed. In a way, the people who have spent a lot have been good citizens in the sense of keeping our economy going. But I think that unfortunately we've taken it too far. Yeah. We're sacrificing individual consumers for the sake of the larger economy.
I think too, it's as you lay out this situation where an individual's thinking about short-term goals and long-term goals. It's the case that if my long-term goal is to have a comfortable retirement, but here in the short term I've decided, well, I really want to have an iPhone. It's not exactly an irrational thing to say, well, if I spend it today, tomorrow, if I spend the $300 on the iPhone, it's really not going to make that much difference to my long-term goal for comfortable retirement, really. Now, if every couple of days I was spending money like that, that would be one thing. But that individual choice, it seems that looking at it one way, you'd have to say, well, that's really not going to make much difference one way or another.
Right. That's the problem, is that you're staring at an item that is concrete. You know you can have it now, you know, and that's very clear. So that part of the choice is clear. What's not clear for people is, well, what effect will this decision have on my future? I mean, will I really not get my retirement because I bought this phone today? And because of the sort of murkiness and vagueness of the future loss of buying this phone, it tilts it in favor of buying. You have to think of it as a stream of behavior. It works much better if you think about, okay, I'm splurging today. Now, what if I were to splurge, you know, consistently, maybe once a month like this, out for years and years? Would I choose that over a string of months in which I'm prudent and save, and therefore have a much larger retirement and savings account at the end? You know, thought of in that way as a choice between two long streams of behavior, most people will make the right decision. But that's not the way we think about it. We think about it as right now, and I want that thing, and can I have it or not? And sure, I can. You know, what's it going to hurt?
Let's talk to a caller, someone in Savoy, line number two. Hello.
That me?
Yes.
Well, hello. I was wondering what the professor could say about the connection between all the psychology departments across the country and the marketing departments and the basic suck them in to go buy things mentality that seems to be out there.
Well, Well, it's a real thing. I don't know how many psychology departments are actually involved in it, but there is a historically, of course, a connection between psychologists and advertising for reasons that you can guess, and there is a ton of new advertising out there. You know, the technological developments that we have experienced in the last few years have opened up all new ways that that we can be bombarded by advertising, which of course creates this motivation to spend. So, you know, the inside doors of elevators now have ads on them, and the tray tables in airplanes, and it seems as though flat screen TVs have invaded restaurants and other places. Any place someone is sitting down, there's a television set that's running, and of course it has advertising as well as CNN or whatever else it has on it. So it is true that there is a very serious effort to try to create advertising wherever we are. It's kind of hard to find a place to rest your eyes where there isn't some commercial image nowadays, and it is a serious problem. I think we need to sort of push it back.
Thank you.
All right. And again, other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. This, I guess, gets at another issue, and that is the skill with which products are marketed to us, and the fact that we have, in some way, we bought into the idea that if we buy something, that we'll be happier, prettier, more popular, sexier. Life will be more satisfying. That everything will be more because I have that Mercedes that I want so much. That somehow my life is going to be better. It's that. Indeed, again, it's one of those things that if you think about it for about 30 seconds, you realize, well, no, that's kind of silly, that it's really not going to do that. And yet we're susceptible to that kind of argument.
We are. And it's been used very effectively in the advertising world. I think that television, you know, being so much a part of our lives and sort of social comparison, the ability to see people on television or in magazines enjoying certain products, appearing happily in a car or wearing a certain piece of clothing, that kind of thing is much more common in today's world than it was before, and it does create this sort of thing like, boy, I'd like to have that too. And the increased exposure to branded images, you know, the idea that you can look at something that someone is wearing and you know from looking at it what company made it. You know, everything that is branded then creates this sort of hierarchy of, is that a high-priced item, a low-priced item? Where do I fit in the scheme of my friends and people I'd like to have as my friends? And that does create desire for things, and again, it's just been carried out so far that I think we ought to rethink it and maybe pull back.
All right, let's talk with someone in Geneva next on our toll free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, yes. Great topic. I think the reason our country is like it is because of the money factor. If I had, you know, the time and the effort to put, instead of going into what I went into in college, going into getting a degree in law and in pharmaceuticals and medical care, you know, like a lot of other people seem to be, and I'd be rolling in the dough, so to speak. But I didn't. I went into something else, and my whole object in my game, living, wasn't to live for money. Now, that doesn't mean that money doesn't, you can't survive without it around here. I find it hard to believe that anybody can survive without, you know, the lack thereof of the funding. But I guess what I'm saying is you brought it all up, but the TV, the news people, especially the media, has a lot to do with how they portray the money. If you look at the number of shows that are reality shows out there, everybody wants to get out there and get that $1 million, you know.
Right.
Where's society going with this? And, you know, it's like, I remember when I was growing up as a kid, you know, now I'm 51, and the whole, it's like the whole ideal of how you get money nowadays is turned upside down on its head. There's no responsibility out there anymore. I had to work for everything I got, and pretty much everybody I grew up with did too. And now, if you look at the way Christmas is, and, you know, Thanksgiving and all these holidays, it's give, you know, and right. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's unfortunately, it's the way our economy works. I mean, there are people making lots of money off of the fact that we spend a lot, and it's the way our economy has changed over the last few decades from a manufacturing economy to a service economy and to a consumer economy. And so we're doing what we're supposed to be doing in one sense when we go out and desire things in the way you say and spend more than we have. The problem is that, you know, it has created a lot of unhappiness for many people and this very difficult situation. You also bring up income. You know, it is true that the people on the lower end of the income curve are the ones most hurt by it. Anyone can get into trouble with debt, but of course if you have a lot of money coming in, it's less likely to be happening and you know, you can usually weather the storm better. But it is true that if we could increase wages and the stability of people's incomes, a lot would change. Many things would be improved by that simple thing.
All right. Again, we're at our midpoint here, and I have another call. I want to thank the last caller, and I do also want to pass on a little bit more weather-related information to folks who are listening. We're expecting, could expect some serious snow here in the central part of the state today, and we're also expecting there will be weather-related closings, and we have that. When we have that information, we'll try to get it to you just as quickly as possible. So in addition to the ones that I mentioned for the St. Joe Ogden schools at the beginning of the program, okay, I'll do that one more time. St. Joe Middle School dismisses at 12:20, St. Joe Grade School 12:30, St. Joe Ogden High School at 12:40, and Prairie View Ogden School at 12:45. So in addition to that, now the Mohammed Seymour schools will be closing all of their buildings 2 hours early. There will be no afternoon kindergarten or pre-kindergarten. And we're posting this information on our web page. So if you go there, you should be able to find it. And of course, as soon as we have this information available, we'll try and pass it on to you as well. This is Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and our guest is Stuart Vise. He's professor of psychology at Connecticut College in New London. He is the author of Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition, a book that won the William James Book Award in 1999, and is the author of a new book, which is titled Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. It's published by the Oxford University Press, which tries to present some of the kind of research that has come out of the field of psychology that maybe helps us understand why people think about money and spending money the way that they do, and maybe what we can do about that. So you can go out and look at the book, and questions are welcome too. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah. You know, the credit card industry certainly protected themselves with the legislation that, you know, in terms of bankruptcy, I think they can get your house and the whole bit now. You know, when you think of, I don't know if it's any higher than that, but 18% interest on money, I mean, it's also an incentive for the credit card industry because they're making such high interest that, you know, they can afford to have people or a certain percentage, you know, not pay that kind of thing and to go after it. There's a whole new industry now where, you know, in terms of, I don't know, whether they sell it for 10 cents on a dollar or something or other, and then they let somebody else go after it. That's one part. The other part is that I think the caller before this last one talked about psychology. I mean, when you compare the sophistication, what he was getting at is that there's a lot of people in psychology or psychology professors that are actually helping marketers to, if you compare advertising today to 10 years ago or 15 years ago, the psychological techniques are just incredible. Absolutely. So I'll just go off the air and let you comment.
All right.
Well, I agree with both comments. Certainly, I think the credit card industry needs much greater regulation than it has now, and the interest rates are enormous, and there's so many different fees that are added on without the customer really knowing that there's a serious problem. And the other thing is this business of people being extended credit and getting into trouble. It's really unclear how credit limits are set on the part of the credit card companies. It's not even clear that they do any real serious analysis of the individual. And yet the person, when they get a credit card, they think, oh, wow, look at, I have this high credit limit. They must think I'm good for it. And they're encouraged to go out and use it. And so that, of course, is a situation that can cause a lot of trouble, and especially if you have these high interest rates. I'm quite certain that psychologists are very much involved. I'm not going to cover up for psychologists in the field of advertising. I think that the advertising people are pretty smart in and of themselves without our help. But it's true. I mean, it's a tremendously powerful industry. And they have it down to a real science, and it's paid off very well. And furthermore, beyond the power of advertising is, as I say, the technological advances that make it so that advertising can go different places. I mean, in large cities now, they are projecting huge images on the sides of buildings at night, you know, to advertise products. Every empty space that our eyes fall upon, they're trying to find a way to put something there. They put advertising literally printed on eggs. A CBS TV program was advertised by putting images on eggs in grocery stores. It's just out of control, and we need a Lady Bird Johnson or somebody to help us push that advertising back.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are advertisers who take advantage of psychological research, but I guess I think it's an industry that's become very sophisticated, and I'm not sure that you have to be a psychologist to understand how that where the strings that you can yank on people are,
right?
To at least get some of them to buy your product.
They could teach us a few things.
Yeah, I'm sure they could. Let's talk next with someone in Danville. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I certainly agree that so much of the advertising is egregious these days in enticing people to, no matter what your credit history is, come in, no interest until, 2009 or so on. But I have to be reminded, and I'd like to mention something that happened a long time ago when I was with my fiance out to dinner with my future parents-in-law. And my father-in-law, in the course of the whatever we were talking about, said, I can buy anything I want. And we all kind of looked up, and then he paused and said, but I have a very clear idea of what I can afford to want. And I've been working on that principle for almost 60 years, and I think you get the best of both worlds.
I agree. That's part of the problem, is to get that perspective, to be able to know which wants we can afford to entertain and which ones we can't. And furthermore, there's also the issue of a growing list of quote needs. And this is something that is addressed in the book too, and by other people. But I'm sorry.
No, that's that was just the noise. The caller hung up there, so it made a clank. But we still got you. You're still on.
Yes, and so in addition to wanting too many things and having trouble keeping those in check, we have decided that certain things are necessities now that never were before. You know, something like 70% of Americans believe that home air conditioning is a necessity now, when that was a much lower number years ago. And of course, innovations like cell phones. I mean, take that as a simple example. You know, a few years back, no one had ever heard of one, and now you're a pariah if you don't have one. And most people still have landline phones, so it becomes just an add-on expense. Some are making the change to just cell phones, but it tends to be an additional expense that is added. And so that's a problem. Innovation is, in some sense, the mother of debt, in the sense that we do tend to acquire all these needs, and suddenly they become needs. Take, for example, something like Lipitor. Now, this is an area that people don't even think about, but Lipitor, you know, the anti-cholesterol drug, is the most profitable drug in the world right now. It's something like $9 billion or something a year, and it never existed before, and no one would ever question that it's a necessity if you have high cholesterol, and of course, so many of us do. But at the same time, it has to be sort of fit into the budget somewhere, and it's not cheap. And so you know, this is also part of the problem, is that we all have needs, and some of those needs can be reevaluated, and we can decide that maybe they're not really necessities after all. But others, like Lipitor, make life difficult.
Well, again, going back to this idea that we have this dramatic expansion of what people feel that they need, with the expansion of people being able to defer payments, getting us into trouble. I guess I still find myself wondering whether people's attitudes toward debt has changed, and particularly whether this is generational, and that is that we have gone from a time when people tended to think that having a lot of debt was not a good thing, or if you possibly could avoid it, it was not a good thing, to a point where maybe now we're very concerned, but in the more recent past, we were a much more casual attitude to the idea of having debt.
Absolutely, I think that's true. I think that what has happened, and I'm sure there are many people out there listening who say, I'm not like this, I'm a saver, and I've always saved, I never buy anything on credit, and that's just the way I am, and so what's the big problem? I think that these things are essentially learned, that we learn the habit of saving, we learn the habit of spending. And there are some people out there whose parents went through the Depression or other hard times, and learn to get through it by being frugal and saving, and pass that on to their children, and so that is true. And unfortunately, I think in the current world, the saving part has been forgotten. It is much less common to run into people who have been very diligent about putting money away all the time, and therefore are deeply in the black. I mean, the savings rate is zero, roughly. And so on average, Americans don't save anything. In fact, they've used, in many cases, their mortgages, their houses, as an escape valve. They the equity kept going up during the good years of the housing boom, and people would cash out money to pay off credit cards or other kinds of debt or to buy things. And now we have part of that problem in front of us.
Yeah. Well, we have some other callers here. Why don't we talk with some more folks and go next? We'll talk with someone in DeKalb, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to, first of all, I liked your comment about the cell phones, how, you know, pretty much if you don't have a cell phone, you're a pariah. It's so true. I have a friend, he's pretty much the only person I know that doesn't have a cell phone, and people pretty much get furious at him.
Yeah, right. And that's a new expense now.
Oh, certainly, yeah. And I honestly can't really blame the guy for not having one. But anyway, what I called to say was, I think it's interesting how people are more or less programmed today to have to, you know, have that success. You know, make as much money as possible, make money above all other things, put your life on hold, you know, neglect your family, pretty much spend your whole life working away to try to, acquire, buy. You know, it's you're almost seen as somewhat of a loser, or, you know, someone who, I don't know, where I'm looking for here. But you're pretty much, you're seen as a loser or a deadbeat if you want to live a humble life with as few things as possible. It's something that people don't even understand nowadays, and I think that's just really unfortunate.
Me too. Yeah, it's true. There is actually a movement of people sort of going in a different direction. It's sometimes referred to as downshifters or the simplicity movement. Juliet Shore, in her book The Overspent American, talks about these groups. But there are a number of people who are trying to deliberately live a more simple life and to eliminate advertising and television in particular from their lives, rather than having leisure time activities that involve spending money. And that is another big thing, is that so many of our leisure time activities now really cost a lot of money. Instead of that, these people are encouraging each other to cook at home and to have people over to the house and do more simple, less commercial forms of leisure time activity and social activity. And many of them find it a much more satisfying life, a simpler, quieter, and in some ways more fulfilling existence. And I think that's something, you know, it's a small thing, but I think it's something we all really need to consider.
Oh, definitely. Pretty much everywhere I look around me, I live in a college town, obviously, so everywhere around me, I have so many people who are so ambitious. It's like the people I work with, they're telling me that they're business majors, but they obviously hate what they're doing. They dread the thought of going into a field of work where, you know, they're doing nothing but working with money all of the time, and it makes me sad because they're pretty much having to dedicate their life to something they don't even want in order to make money, in order to buy things, in order to basically in order to acquire physical possessions, which in the end really don't solve any problems. I mean,
right?
Yeah.
No, it's true. I mean, I think personally, I think that, you know, fulfilling work that makes you feel good and that is meaningful to you is really important. And obviously these people, it sounds like, aren't going in that direction. And then the other thing is that we need time. You know, that once you have a family and you have mature social relationships, then you need the time to work with those and to enjoy them. And I think a lot of people are realizing that the rat race and the pursuit of money and the pursuit of things is actually an obstacle to things that are much more satisfying.
And I appreciate the last caller, and I just have about 5 minutes, so I wanted to get on some others. But I also want to mention the fact that in the book you do have some practical suggestions, things that people can do to deal with the forces that we've talked about. And certainly, as we've discussed, advertising is all around us. Well, it is possible that you can limit your exposure, it is also possible that you can do things like, for example, if there are bills that must be paid, you can arrange so that they're automatically paid. So that will happen. I mean, there are some very practical things that one can do. But it sounds as if the big kind of issue here is a values issue, and that is that you would encourage people to think about what truly is important to them, and then make decisions accordingly.
Absolutely, that is definitely part of it. Is to ask yourself, you know, for example, I encourage people to ask serious questions about their television sets. You know, I would say that when I'm on my deathbed and I'm thinking back and I think about the things that I have done in life, I probably will say to myself, I probably will not say to myself, gee, I wish I'd watched another Law and Order episode before I died, you know. And the fact of the matter is that that there are things that are more rewarding. And you just need the time and the space to enjoy them. So yes, I think that part of it is that. And unfortunately, so many people are into this sort of TV and commercial and celebrity society that we have, that it's hard to be the one who turns away from it. But I would encourage that. And the other part that you mentioned is trying to use the psychology of self-control to help you save, in particular, and also live within your means. And so you mentioned this business of automatic bill paying, and I recommend that people do that, but I also recommend that they actually do it in a separate checking account that you don't use, so that you have a deposit that goes into a separate checking account. As many of your ongoing bills are paid automatically out of that account, also an automatic withdrawal into a savings account comes out of that account, so that what you're left with in a different checking account, your spending account, is your true disposable income. And you don't get fooled by the ups and downs of your balance. Your savings goes on invisibly without your having to do anything, whether you do anything or not. And the thing that you make decisions about is your true disposable income. And that's a way to sort of make savings easy. It doesn't have to take a deliberate effort on your part. And spending becomes more manageable, too.
All right. Let us go on to another caller. And coming up next, I think that we'll talk with we have a little not up here in our phone system. We get that taken care of. Okay, there we go. Thank you, Jason. We'll go next to caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. First, I want to make a quick comment, which has nothing to do with the question I'm going to ask, but as regarding Lipitor, there's been a good deal of research on the market lately. I mean, on the market. the Internet and other good sources that throw some real serious questions about the efficacy and wisdom of everyone taking Lipitor. I just want to mention that because I think that's another advertising thing. I realize that our guest is a psychologist and his interest seems to be in consumer behavior, but I have a long-standing grudge against the public schools because kids graduate from high school even with good grades, and they don't know beans about what credit cards really are. They don't understand interest. They don't understand how it accumulates. They don't know how to keep their bank accounts. They don't know how to save. They how to resist advertising and commercial messages, how to examine them critically. They're not taught any of this in school.
Right.
I just think that's absolutely vital, and I had to get it off my system. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the point, and I expect, Professor Vise, that you would say that having some consumer education, having that kind of stuff be part of the school curriculum would be a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are some states that mandate some financial education and consumer education in the public schools, but it needs to be done more systematically and everywhere. It's not clear that for example, the simple concept of compound interest, which affects both savings and credit cards, is not understood by the majority of Americans or many Americans, and so that's a problem. And I think that much better financial education would be helpful. There are a couple of websites that are in the book that point to specific programs for teaching children about resisting advertising and consumer education for young children. And I think that's really important because, the whole advertising ploy is being pushed to younger and younger age levels so that kids want things, at much younger ages and work on their parents to get them.
All right. Let's go to another caller. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
A slightly different direction, but I wonder if your guests could comment on the, I'll call them the boys and girls in Washington, D.C., who don't know how to save and don't know how to live within their means and spend us into unbelievable amounts of debt on the federal level. I mean, states have to spend within their means, but the feds just keep spending like there's no tomorrow.
Right. Yeah.
They set a bad example for everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we are a nation of debtors, and it's true of our government as well. Yeah, and there are really sort of three areas of debt. There is consumer debt. You know, individual consumers have a lot of debt. The government, of course, is in debt, as we all know, and also corporations are in debt. You know, so the whole country runs this way. It is a bad circumstance. Now, the states, of course, can't go into debt, and so you have these tremendous sort of crises that hit at the state level because of it. But it does have the positive effect of their sort of living within their means. But no, it's everywhere, and I think that it does help to sort of create this norm that it's okay, that things will work out, and we do worry even on the national level that this is going to be a problem sometime in the future.
Hmm. Well, we're at the point here where essentially we're going to have to stop, and I'm sorry, we have one last person that we can't take. Just as a way of finishing up here, what sort of thought would you like to leave with folks?
Well, I would like to encourage people to think about how the marketplace is a part of their lives and how we are confronted with it every minute of the day, and think about ways that you could push it back a little bit. You know, remove yourself from advertising, delay purchases so that you don't make them on an immediate basis, and think about ways to save money instead of spend it.
Mm. So it sounds as if there's really no sort of magical bullet here, really, because people are going to have to make some deliberate effort and have to make some deliberate choices.
Right. And it's too big a thing to sort of wipe away with one little suggestion. I make a number of suggestions in the book, and I hope that by reading the book, people will sort of have a better sense of what we're confronted with. But there are definitely things that you can do that help.
All right. Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Our guest is Stuart Vise. His last name, by the way, spelled V-Y-S-E. He's professor of psychology at Connecticut College in New London. He is the author of the book Going Broke, Why Americans Can't Hold On to Their Money. It's published by the Oxford University Press. You might also be interested in his earlier book, Believing in Magic, The Psychology of Superstition. That book won the William James Book Award in 1999. Today's broadcast here on Focus 580, made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer on Route 45 in Savoy, online at wardenmartin.com, information at 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more news, information, and certainly information about the weather coming up today as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the
that's
host, Celeste
right.
Quinn.
Yeah, a lot of weather to talk about this afternoon. Mike Sola will be with us at 12:35 this afternoon with a look at the forecast and current conditions. In the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with a family physician and geriatrician, Dr. Dennis McCullough. We will talk with him about his book, My Mother, Your Mother, Embracing Slow Medicine, The Compassionate Approach to Caring for Your Aging Loved Ones. Let's turn our attention now to the commodity markets. And today we don't have that March wheat contract from Kansas City. So let's go ahead and go to Chicago. March wheat in Chicago, 1074, down 19. July, 1003, down 16. March corn, 548, down 7.5. May, 558 and 3/4, down 7.75. July, 570 and a quarter, down 8. December, 566.5, down 9.5. March soybeans, 1512, down 32.5. May, 1528, down 31.5. July, 1538, down 32. November, 1408, down 39.5. March meal, 372.10, down 490. March oil, 6805, down 235. April live cattle at the Merck in Chicago, 91.20, down 145. June, 92.80, down 157.5. March feeder cattle, 101.10, down 57.5. April, 104.35, down 60. And April lean hogs, 56.90, that down 190. Outside markets, April crude, $100.